University Film and Film Studies Initiative Working Group. The group began as an ad hoc group of media, visual history, and culture-oriented faculty, staff, and librarians to promote information exchange about teaching film and teaching with film. Members of this group are some are here today and available for testimony or questions later as needed. So from that point of view, I'm representing them, and we are here to testify in support of the proposed educational exemptions of the works from the DMCA prohibition. Now, first, in the interest of full disclosure, I am also a member of other groups supporting the exemptions today and are represented by the panel. I am also on the board of directors of the Consortium of College and University Media Centers, and our group are supporting their testimony. I am also the chair of CCUMC's Government Regulations and Public Policy Committee. I'm also a member of the American Library Association and a founder and past president of ALA's Video Roundtable, of which you heard the testimony of Gary Hanman in California, and we are co-signers of that document that he presented. I'm also on the VRT Executive Committee, and I'm also a member of ALA's Office of Information Technology Policy Video Roundtable Working Group on Best Practices in Fair Use for Librarians. So just giving you that perspective that I'm working with these faculty, and the faculty wanted to have a voice here today to talk about what their perspective is. So, again, a little bit background again. I offer as evidence the fact that our library is one of the oldest and largest video resource centers in academic libraries. It opened in 1973, primarily as an audiovisual learning and curricular environment for undergraduates. The use of media by our faculty has never waned in these years. There has been exponential growth since video became easily accessible and procurable. As students from the 70s, 80s, and 90s grew up and became teachers, media collections became a preferred text for many, many classes. Our collection comprises documentary and educational works, primary source materials, news and television programs, as well as research-level collections of international feature films. As we serve a research function, we continue to maintain access to all our obsolete and legacy format collections, unless they've been replaced by new formats. And at the same time, we acquire these new commercially available materials in the best available, most usable format, which, of course, is today the DVD. Our Film and Film Studies Initiative Working Group members represent diverse nationalities, ages, genders, orientations, perspectives. We, and I'm part of this group, we use media from a variety of disciplines, backgrounds, and countries. We teach and or support classes with the word film, cinema, movies, and the like in the title and in the course description. But we teach even more classes without these words in the title. And as learners of media, we have used all forms of media. As teachers and librarians, we use all formats to connect our current teaching to our students, to use all forms of educational technology with it to enhance this teaching. So which departments and programs are the biggest users of our collection? Well, the University of Maryland is the largest university system in the Baltimore-Washington area, and the College Park campus is one of the largest in the immediate Washington, D.C. area. But the university does not have a film studies program, and that is unlike most of the other area universities. Yet we teach or support many classes with the word film, cinema, movies, and the like, and we teach even more classes without them. We teach classes with the words images and movements and sound and speeches and colors and emotions, representations in the content of the class. And for our students, the realities inherent in teaching this context exist for hours and minutes and seconds. The learning exists in real time, as in film reel, and real time, as in time. And the persistence of vision for days, months, years, and a lifetime in our classes. So I refer you again to all the class of Category 4 documents that have been submitted. I even received a Twitter tweet before I turned off the phone from our other viewers in the background saying they agree with everything that everyone said up to me, and I'm sure after this, and wish to point to that. I have a handout floating, I guess, with the folks up there that lists our departments and our classes that use media. Both the ones that have film or something like that in the title and the ones that do not. In the list of departments, you'll see just about every department in our university uses some, has a class or two or three that uses some sort of film. And when I say film, I don't mean film. I mean, it can be video, can be any of the formats before, but of course, the majority is DVD at this particular time. You'll also see, or the people have this document, that there are some classes that are core classes that are not film classes, but they rely so much on film that it's become an integral part of every class session. These classes are core classes. They have 200-plus students. They meet, unfortunately, only 50 or 75-minute lectures two or three times a week, and none of these classes feature a face-to-face showing of an entire work, but multiple clips are needed for each and every meeting. Just as an aside, films, documentaries, we've not really talked about the documentary film, but obviously that is the majority of the things that our people show. And the same rules, as far as the exemptions apply to those, as the dramatic works that we're existing for most materials. As noted in prior testimony, teaching with a pedagogical perspective requires the ability to compare sequences or scenes in same or multiple works, to zero in on a sequence that addresses a specific point being made in class, to incorporate clips into the context of PowerPoint presentations, educational learning systems such as Blackboard. This technique has become central to teaching and is exactly the same as the strong pedagogical arguments offered last year, which lead to the expansion of circumvention allowances for film studies and media studies. Before DVDs arrived on the scene, our group knew how to appropriately and reasonably use video in a classroom teaching and how to exercise fair use to accept a limited number of short clips. Current prohibitions have, in a sense, trumped these fair use rights and have created a roadblock for our media literate faculty and other academic users. None of our group wants to violate a law. DMCA has basically prevented faculty and librarians from doing our jobs effectively and legally and taking full advantage of educational technologies. We do not believe that there are any workable technical alternatives to circumvention. It's clear to any teacher who has stood behind a lectern that shuffling multiple DVDs in order to show various clips or using a remote in the dark to find clips on a single disc does not work. Inserting a disc in an open tray and arriving at the menu takes an average of 50 seconds. To find a chapter 5 takes an additional 15 to 20 seconds. This is time lost for teaching in class and after class. DVD and Blu-ray are likely to be the first of a long list of incompatible digital video formats that librarians and educators will need to deal with in the future. No rule written today should be allowed to tie the hands of tomorrow's educators. In summary, we believe that we will continue to need access to discrete portions of legally acquired video information in all formats, even if exemptions are not allowed. The current prohibitions have the unfortunate effect of criminalizing proven pedagogical practice. Moving images are the texts of the world's culture, and limiting circumvention allowances to the formal academic programs as film and media studies, and limiting the exemption to the use of materials in departmental or campus libraries is completely unrealistic in light of current teaching practice, current institutional resources, and evolving trends in education and scholarship. In the 21st century, a literate population is a democratic requirement. Audiovisual content is at least secondary and often primary information sources of most people, and this means that studies for all disciplines, all subjects, if media is involved in any way, are in effect like film studies, and at its broadest point, it is media studies and media literacy. Our faculty needs access to media sources in whole and in part and in the best available format to teach with clarity and depth. And I urge the Librarian of Congress and his advisors to expand current exemptions in order to support the legitimate teaching, learning, and research needs of faculty and students for today and tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now move on to Martine Courant-Rye. Okay. And you have something to show us?
For the end of my presentation, I wanted to be able to show this.
Sure. Okay. Well, you want to just give us your presentation first and then
do that? Yeah, we'll have a handout,
too. Great, great. Oh, and by the way,
it's actually the only one that I have.
Okay. Carlton Jackson, you said you had a handout of some sort. It hasn't made its way to us yet.
Okay.
So please make sure we do get it.
I will. And the testimony. Thank you.
The microphone.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for having me here today. My name is Martine Courant-Reif, and I'm my institutional affiliations are Lansing Community College and Michigan State University. I have been studying for the last 3 or 4 years the impact of copyright law on the chilling of digital speech. My study, which I completed, which was part of my dissertation, was called Is There a Chilling of Digital Communication? And it was an empirical mixed method study that included a digital survey taken by a randomly selected population of professional writers and interviews with digital student writers working in educational settings. My study was approved by the Michigan State University Institutional Review Board for the Ethical Treatment of Human Subjects. I explored knowledge levels about copyright law and also levels of chilled digital speech, i.e., is copyright law chilling speech? The study was written into my dissertation, Rhetorical Invention in Copyright and Viewed Environments. My research was funded in part by a grant from the College of Arts and Letters at Michigan State University and supported by the Writing in Digital Environments Research Center at Michigan State University. And my appearance here as well has been supported by both Lansing Community College and Michigan State University, and I've been helped and counseled by many colleagues prior to my appearance here, including the co-directors of the WIDE Research Center, Drs. Jeff Grable and William Hart Davidson, whose support I have here today. I also have the almost 400 participants of my study supporting my appearance here, as I have a very overwhelming responsibility to them to push some of the issues that arose in my study forward. These people donated about 30 minutes of their time without being paid to do my study so that I could get a PhD. So I'm indebted to them. I teach composition at both the university and the community college level. Most of my teaching experience has been at the community college, where latest statistics show that almost half of all students will attend, particularly for their first year writing requirement. I just finished teaching my first graduate course at Michigan State, Composition Studies, Issues, Theories, and Research, and I have PhD students and MA students in my class. I tell you this to indicate my level of expertise with the literature and research in writing studies, as we have some research that might inform your decision here today, in addition to my study. I'm also a licensed attorney with an active license to practice in Michigan and an inactive license in Colorado. I was admitted to practice law in 1985. I want to be clear here that I'm defining writing broadly throughout my testimony to include multimedia text, including audiovisual compositions, and, of course, alphabetic text. And what I have at the end, I hope, is to be able to show you an example of student writing that would be legal because it's fair use, but for the DMCA. My handout, I passed out, I only made 30 copies, so this is in the hands of the Copyright Office, and I'm also happy to give anyone copies who didn't get one if you just let me know. I'm not going to read from a handout, I'll let you read it on your own time, but what I want you to extract from that is that digital writers, teachers, and students in professional writing programs are people who will act ethically and legally when given a reasonable opportunity to do so. But like most educated people, will evaluate any given situation in order to assess how reasonable the law is. We understand about civil rights and free speech in the academy, and we care about these things. We also care about copyright law. We want to learn more, and we think fair use is very important. We want to do the legal thing and the right thing, but these are responsible, smart people that I'm arguing for here. These are the people I'm representing. And my handout also shows evidence, empirical evidence, that copyright law is chilling speech. I understand by reading the 2006 recommendation written by Mary Beth Peters that you're looking for ways to limit the exemption. I understand that. So what I'm going to do is offer some language that cuts across all of the fours, and then I'm going to justify that. And tomorrow I'm arguing for something broader, so this is my argument in the alternative. The exemption that I'm arguing for is motion picture and audiovisual works released on DVD, comma, housed in a U.S. library collection where the student attends or where the teacher is employed, comma, or legally obtained and owned by the teacher slash student, comma, where circumvention is undertaken solely for the purpose of extracting clips for the inclusion in videos or multimedia texts that do not infringe copyright and that are composed either as part of student coursework or as part of course curriculum. This exemption shall apply even for works that are gifted from students slash teachers to community groups slash nonprofits as part of service learning or community outreach. In justification of that last part of this class that I kind of is part of my testimony as trying to synthesize everyone's wish from the educational community, service learning and community literacy, we have a literature of that in composition of rhetoric. I'm asking the copyright, the Register of Copyrights, to see the writing classroom not just as something that takes place in the four walls. We're working very hard, and we have a literature to professionalize undergraduates. So I'm frequently asked to be a guest speaker in first-year writing classes where students are doing work for community members, doing writing for community members, and they want to be sure that the works they create aren't creating liability for nonprofits that they're working with. So there is an active effort with community outreach. So I'm asking for the exemption not to be limited to classrooms and for there to be some way to see that through. I'm also asking for the exemption not to be limited to face-to-face environments. During this last academic year, I taught 8 virtual classes. I would have had no use for this exemption. Online teaching environments are increasing exponentially, and not only that, but Angel and Blackboard course management systems are used in face-to-face teaching environments. I always use them when I teach face-to-face. Students are uploading assignments there. And there's also hybrid. We also have hybrid classes now, which are half online and half face-to-face, or how different institutions configure them differently. So to limit the exemption to face-to-face is to harm disenfranchised students and teachers working in online spaces, spaces which are also leveraged now in face-to-face environments. I'm also asking you not to limit the exemption to library use. Let me tell you why. At Lansing Community College, our holdings are so much less than at Michigan State University. So the students at Lansing Community College, they have less fair use than the students at Michigan State when you do that. We have, at Lansing Community College, we have 2% of the amount of books that Michigan State does. We have 25%. They have 75% more digital materials than we do at Lansing Community College. Also, in the student student writing I'm going to show you, these are popular movies. And I checked at Lansing Community College and Michigan State University Library. Neither library has any of these clips. I looked at the top movies that are available in DVD, The Dark Knight, Hancock, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of Crystal Skull, Iron Man, National Treasure, Into the Wild, 310 to Yuma. None of these popular movies are owned by either Michigan State University or Lansing Community College Library. So if I was to give a writing prompt, which would be typical, examine images of men, women, Asians, African Americans, etc., in the most recent movies, i.e. popular culture. Create a multimodal argument incorporating text, visuals, and sound about how these people are represented in the media. On the exemption that the way you have crafted it now, limited to libraries, my students would be not able to complete this assignment realistically. So there's chilled speech. I am asking that students be able to use DVDs like they use books. If they could, I would encourage them to purchase DVDs like they purchase books. I don't understand why the motion picture industry would want to tie this into the library rather than encourage individuals to buy these. I don't buy DVDs because I can't use them in the way that I need to use them. I would use Camtasia. I would be making film clips in my classes. I would be making film compilations, but I don't do that because I'm considered an expert on copyright law, so people look to me as a role model, so I can't be actively infringing or inducing my students potentially to infringe. I can't do that and sleep at night. So please try to imagine students and teachers as active producers of text and not just consumers, because that's how the motion picture industry is contextualizing us as consumers. VHS, I think we've heard enough testimony about that. It's basically a collector's item at this point. I don't have any VHS players in my house anymore because you can't rent that, and I have no use for them. I wouldn't have a clue how to get something in VHS into digital format, which is what's going to be required for delivery at this point. Why permissions don't work, I have something to add to the arguments. I think it's Time Warner that argued last year and also this year that permissions just aren't soft but should be. Since no one has ever appeared from my field writing studies, I can explain that permissions, the idea of permissions or asking permissions to use or be sent movie clips 3 to 5 days ahead depends on something false, which is a linear model of writing process. Writing is not, we have research in our field going back 30 years that clearly demonstrates writing is not linear, but it's recursive. And the writer revisits and revises decisions multiple times, continuously synthesizing information and changing things around. And here I cite the work by Flower and Hayes, Janet Emig, Sandra Pearl, Lee O'Dell, and my study that examined digital composing process. Some digital texts that arose in my study took over 150 hours and many months to complete. Some took years to create. Some were created by multiple authors over a period of many years, where one author wrote for a while and then another one took over. Time Warner's view of writing is this: you know exactly what movie clips you need, you ask for them, you receive them, you place them in your text in specific places, and voila, you are finished. Would that it were writing were that simple, it would make my job so much easier. However, writing is complicated and it's recursive. And also realistically, does the motion picture industry want 1,000 requests per academic year just from my students? I worked with almost 100 students this year. There's 5 writing assignments in each class. Realistically, that would be 1,000 requests just from me alone. I also ask you, although this isn't exactly relevant, Section 1202C8, specifically in the context of copyright management information, it specifically tells the register not to require any personal identifying information about a user of a work or of a copy, et cetera. And that appears in 2 places of the statute, in C and in subsection 8. And I think that gives a spirit that a user shouldn't have to identify themselves. They have to identify the copyright information. But there's a reason for that language being in this other section of Title 17. Read that in context with Section 107. Mary Beth Peters, in her prior recommendation, said she would only grant the exemption if, 1, it's not a matter of mere convenience, 2, there's no alternative formats, 3, the use will be non-infringing. For number 3, I want to show the student work, which I'm arguing is a fair use, and my legal citations on that are Campbell versus A. Cuff Rose, 1994 Supreme Court opinion, as well as the Second Circuit case of Graham Archives versus Dorling Kindersley, 2006. It's not a matter of mere convenience, and this is my writing studies perspective. There is a stark difference between convenience and normalcy. If I buy a book, it's not merely convenient for me to be able to lay it open on the table next to me and type a quote directly in my computer, or if in e-book format, to cut and paste the text into my composition. This whole idea of having writers move away from their computers to use expensive and complicated VHS conversion equipment, or to purchase expensive camcorders and record the screens of other media devices and then import this into their digital compositions, even though they own the DVD, which they can easily view on the computer. The computer is the tool we write with now. This is like requiring me to first handwrite the alphabetic quote I want to take from the book I own, laying open on the table next to my computer, and then go outside and hand chisel that quote in a rock. Take a picture of it with my digital camera, bring it back into the house and download the digital picture of the chiseled rock back into my computer so that I can obtain the quote from the book laying there on the table next to me. It's not mere convenience at this point. It's normalcy. Please don't craft an exemption such that writing teachers are forced to teach students bizarre, abnormal, and unseemly workarounds to what is occurring naturally in digital composing environments. The computer is the tool we write with now. And the issue of there's no alternative formats, we've already had testimony today about how the VHS is an antique. So I'm not going to argue any more on that. I want to give an example. I discussed this in the handout of my student writing, of some student writing that I collected during the empirical study. This is the kind of work that the DMC prohibits. It was performed both in an academic conference. It was performed in a classroom setting, and it was submitted for credit towards a degree. And again, none of the movies, except for the 1997 version of Men in Black, is available at either library that I'm associated with. So I was going to show it real quick. It's not very long. Is that? I want to also inform you about the idea of writing and composition. This is not this is like 25% of the composition, what I'm showing you, because, and this is relevant to the Graham Archives case that I cited, one of the factors that court said to look at was how much of the creator's new ideas are appearing in the composition. And in this case, the student would have been standing up in front of the audience at an academic conference talking about how she was going to show how African Americans are represented in popular movies, citing literature within the field, contextualizing, explaining the whole conference presentation in a max of 15 minutes, then showing one example of how violence against African American women are offered up for the public's entertainment, and then stop this composition and give some more information, and then show a montage about how African Americans are stereotyped in three different ways, and she had different categories she put them in. I'll just show one example of a montage that I'm talking about. where's the mouse? Okay, so this would be playing in the background.
Move over to where the button is. There you go.
Sorry. Wait, I don't want this one to show first.
Shazam! Up yours, child, turkey!
Traitor!
You whine, sucker!
Lunch is not a class, Shorty.
It is when you got the munchies.
See, that's why you such a dumbass.
Your mother.
You my brother. That's your mother too, jackass.
Oh, yeah. But ain't your father stupid?
So? I don't know him.
Yeah, me neither.
Shorty, I know you ain't driving without no papers.
I got papers, blunts, bongs, all the ingredients to make a high nigga pie.
Well, even if I had an extra man, who would want such a bullshit assignment? Well, it's a disgrace to me. It's a disgrace to my department. It's a disgrace to... Dan, I'm sending someone right over.
All right. It's okay. It's all right. FBI. Take a picture. It's okay. Wait a minute. You just kicked me? You must be out of your mind. You want some of me? I'm finna give you a LAPD ass kicking. Come. That was childish, man. That wasn't even called for. Now, I came down here to see Juntao, because he told me to come down here, because I'm his half-brother from Beijing. Me and him got the same mama. I'm black in these. I feel the buzz!
Tyler!
Come on! Come on!
Tyler!
Come on, Lee!
I'm not gonna waste everyone's time some more, but that's just an example of the montage. There were three sections to that, contextualized with academic writing. The first clip was a single clip of I think it was from Scary Movie, and it's basically an African-American woman being stabbed to death in a movie theater while everybody cheers the other people on, and it's really quite disturbing. But anyway, that was, this is an example of something that is definitely fair use under the four-factor analysis, and something that we'd like our students to be able to do, not just in face-to-face classroom settings. And so that's the end of my talk.
Very good. Thank you. All right, I believe we're going to move on to Fritz Attaway, who I assume will express his gratitude to the previous...
David, if it's possible, can we reorder briefly? I'll introduce it.
Okay.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the chance to be here again, representing the 9 copyright industry organizations, the joint creators and copyright owners. I spoke about the Exemption 4 issue in some detail at the Palo Alto hearing, so I'm not going to repeat all that, especially in the interest of time. Let me just say, in an attempt to kind of frame what you're going to be hearing from the next few witnesses, we've seen in the submissions there are many, many examples given of educational uses of commercial audiovisual material. And we've seen a lot more examples today and heard a lot more talked about, and we look forward to actually reviewing this testimony and the submissions and seeing, getting a little more detail on some of the proposals that were brought forward today for the first time. But I think I can say that almost without exception, I hate to say absolutely no exception, but virtually everything we saw, we have no objection to. We think these are perfectly legitimate uses and valuable educational uses of this material. So we don't object to virtually any of the uses we've been shown of these works. We do object to the Copyright Office and the librarian under this Section 1201A rulemaking, granting permission to circumvent access controls in order to make these uses, when there are a host of other alternatives that are available that would not put our valuable intellectual property in the clear and at risk. And I think what you're going to hear mainly, if not exclusively, from the next few witnesses is about the alternatives. So let's put that issue of whether these are good uses or bad uses aside. We support these uses, and the question is how do you make these uses? How do you get from point A to point B? We want Mrs. Scheffler to be able to show her 3 2-minute clips in the English class in Texas. We want the police academy to see those scenes that are overflowing with body language and emotion. We even want people to learn about the trademark rights of heroin dealers. So let's just put all that aside and start talking about the alternatives. Before we turn to the alternatives, I do just want to make a comment about our proposals or our suggestions for narrowing the existing exemption. And Professor DeCherney's right, we did not oppose, if the office finds that the burden of persuasion has been met, we wouldn't oppose an exemption similar to what it currently exists. We did have several suggestions for narrowing. Professor DeCherney referred to a few of them, and I'll just briefly mention that first, we think that the evidence still, with a lot more evidence today, we may miss something, but overwhelmingly this evidence is about audiovisual works that are on DVD protected by CSS. There may be a few stray examples that don't fit that categorization, but virtually everything does, and we think that any exemption you recognized should be conformed to the evidence that's presented to you. Second, we think it should only, the exemption should only apply when it's truly necessary to circumvent in order to create a clip compilation. Specifically, we think that a consensual path or a permissions path, obviously that is a non-infringing use. And if that is available, and obviously that's a contested issue, but unless the proponents can show that it is not available, and we think there will be evidence to the contrary next few minutes, then the exemption should not apply. The necessary language is something you have used before. You have also used before in other exemptions the limitation that all existing digital copies of a work must contain the access controls that prevent the use that's in question. This is not an unworkable standard, and it can certainly be applied in a practical way, but there are many more alternatives available now, some of which you will hear about in the testimony. And it's not unreasonable to say you can't circumvent if you can find it, if there's a reasonably available alternative means that doesn't require circumvention. Again, you've used this in the e-book exemption for the last two rulemaking proceedings, I believe. We believe that any exemption should be limited to what's necessary solely for the purpose of creating the clip compilations for educational use, again, phrasing that you've used in other exemptions. And finally, we think it is important to specify who is able to engage in this circumvention, who's able to exercise this. And now that the office has moved down the path of defining exemptions by particular categories of uses and users, I think it's important to give as much clarity as possible on who is entitled to exercise the exemption. We disagree with the proposal that this should be extended to students, and we can certainly talk about that. That's obviously an exponential increase in the universe of people by any standard who are able to exercise the exemption, and as it's a big step on the path towards circumvention becoming the normative behavior, and that's certainly not something we would like to see. So in any event, we think it's important that the exemption, if you grant any exemption in this area, it should specify clearly who is entitled to exercise it and who is not. Finally, I would like to, because of an issue that came up in the last hearing, I just wanted to briefly state something for the record on this question of Snagit. At the hearing in Palo Alto on May 1st, Rob Kasnick played clips from feature films and trailers that he stated that he had excerpted from a commercial DVD protected by the Content Scramble system using a software tool called Snagit. This demonstration was the subject of questions from the Copyright Office to panelists appearing at the hearing, including questions to me as counsel to the joint creators and copyright owners. This is the first time that the nine organizations we represent have been asked to take a position on the use of this software tool. In fact, as far as we know, it's the first time it's ever been mentioned in this rulemaking proceeding. The next business day after the May 1st meeting, we convened a meeting of our organizations to discuss the questions posed, at least to the best of my recollection, since no transcript is available yet. Of course, we were also discussing many other issues in preparation for the 3 days of public hearings that have begun today here on many other topics. Clearly, a response to the questions posed, again, as I recollect them, will require a full understanding of how the Snagit tool works in its various applications, how, if at all, it interacts with the various technological protection measures employed in CSS and many other technical issues, and would then seem to call for a legal analysis and opinion about whether use of this tool constitutes a violation of Section 1201A1, and if so, whether uses in a particular setting would fall within one of eight proposed exemptions that are contained in the notice of proposed rulemaking. Our organizations don't have enough familiarity with this particular application to provide that analysis today, especially considering that only two business days have elapsed since we were first asked to do so. As we stated in our previous submission, as we repeated on May 1st, as we are reiterating today, we strongly believe that the proponents of the proposed exemptions 4A through D and 4F through H have not satisfied their burden of demonstrating that the prohibition contained in Section 1201A1 is having a sufficient adverse impact on the non-infringing uses they wish to make the audiovisual works at issue to justify an exemption. In part, this is because alternative means not requiring circumvention are available to them and would satisfy their legitimate pedagogical needs. One important such means is the camcording of excerpts of the works from a TV screen or monitor. This means will be demonstrated at this hearing, and you can judge for yourself how it compares with the example that Professor DeCherny provided of circumvention under the current exemption. There will be discussion of the availability of uses with permission or consent, as I mentioned. Of course, those are non-infringing uses. There may well be other means discussed as well. For the reasons I've stated, we're not in a position today to give our views on the technical and legal issues surrounding use of the Snagit tool in this context. Of course, we would do our best to respond to any written questions or any questions that appear in the hearing transcript after we've had a reasonable opportunity to undertake the analysis that's summarized above. So I'd like to turn it over at this point to Fritz Attaway for the next presentation.
Okay. I was so certain that you were going to give us a break.
We thought we'd give you guys a break when we reach the end of the testimony and before we go into questions.
You're tough, particularly for a guy my age. I will necessarily be brief.
If you're telling us you're not up to it without a break, Fritz, we'll break now. But
No. I can hold out. Thank you. As Steve pointed out, a great deal of the testimony that we've heard so far goes to the fact that movie clips are an effective educational tool. And, of course, we have no issue with that. We agree with it. They are an effective educational tool, and we have no problem with them being used for that purpose. The issue here is whether movie clips are readily available without having to engage in circumvention of a technical protection measure. Jonathan Band pointed out in his testimony that the circumvention utility for CSS, which protects DVDs from copying, is readily available. That we all understand that. Nonetheless, CSS has been an extremely effective protection measure because it's inconvenient and the copies it produces are not always of optimum quality. That is what keeps most people from illegally using the circumvention utility, and it's what makes CSS effective and useful in protecting the integrity of our copyrighted movies. Now, if you accept in this proceeding inconvenience or lack of optimal quality as justification for circumvention, you've basically voided the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA and frustrated the intent of Congress. That should not be the standard here, convenience or optimal quality. The standard here should be whether film clips are reasonably available without having to circumvent. And the essence of our testimony here is that they are. Now, just for the record, you know that the Second Circuit has said that, quote, we know of no authority for the proposition that fair use as protected by the Copyright Act, much less the Constitution, guarantees copying by the optimum method or in the ideal format of the original. The Copyright Office has said repeatedly, I'll quote from the 2003 review proceeding, quote, existing case law is clear that fair use does not guarantee copying by the optimum method or in the identical format of the original, unquote. So I think it's pretty clear that convenience and optimal quality are not the standard here. The vast majority of audiovisual works are available in some form in the clear. On VHS, on broadcast television, on cable channels, on satellite channels, and frequently on the internet. Clearly, for that material, there's no justification, there's no need for a DMCA exemption of technical measures that may be applied to that same material in other formats. For the material that is not available in the clear, or when it's not convenient to access that material, there's yet another way to exercise non-infringing uses, and that is by taking screenshots off of a television or computer monitor. Second Circuit Court of Appeals and the Copyright Office has both mentioned this opportunity as a legitimate alternative or an effective alternative to circumvention. Second Circuit said, quote, the DMCA does not impose even an arguable limitation on the opportunity to make a variety of traditional fair uses of DVD movies, such as recording portions of the video images and sounds on film or tape by pointing a camera or camcorder or a microphone at a monitor as it displays the DVD movie, unquote. The Copyright Office has made similar statements in its DMCA review decisions. Having said that, my colleague Dan Seymour is going to demonstrate how taking shots off of a television monitor or a computer monitor produces a can produce clips of movies easily, using equipment that is readily available and affordable, and producing a result that is certainly comparable to the clips that we've seen here this morning and that have been offered as a reason why circumvention is necessary. I think our demonstration will show you that, in fact, circumvention is not necessary to produce the kind and quality of film clips that the educators that we've heard today would like to use. And with that, Dan, it's all yours.
Thank you, Fritz. Instead of trying to do a live camcord demo, we actually recorded a camcord of a TV screen. So I'd like to play that first. And then after that, I will play the result of that camcording. So here's the setup, which is we use a tripod to obviously to minimize shake. Now there's a camcord, which gets mounted for this particular session. We captured the audio directly from the DVD player. You can see the image that we're recording is in the upper right. And incidentally, using this method, you can, once you have the setup, you can find a clip, record it, stop the recording, change your disc, find another clip, start the recording, record your clip, so you can get multiple clips from multiple discs, one right after another. And now she's just adjusting the zoom. The issue here is to get the frame so that there's no external, no parts of the TV itself in the image. And we've always found that it's best to do these recordings in the dark. So this is the actual session. And I won't go through the entire clip because I want to show you the result. Oops, sorry. Now, this is the resulting camcord clip.
We've got to be able to defend ourselves. And if Umbridge refuses to teach us how, we need someone who will.
I'm a nutter, remember?
Look on the bright side.
Can't be any worse than old Toad Face. Thanks, Ron. I'm here for you, mate. Who's supposed to be meeting us then?
Just a couple of people.
Now, that was recorded off of a TV monitor. What I'd like to do very, very quickly, these are 18-second clips, is show you a camcord of a clip off of a computer monitor and then the DCSS version of the same clip.
That we obtained from the Copyright Office website that was submitted by Professor DeCherney.
Thank you.
Was this a Blu-ray that you took it off with? What's
the no, that was standard DVD. This again is the camcord. And this is Professor DeCherney's.
One caveat. Submitted on DVD, but then recoded and then uploaded to the internet, so there's a number of transitions before it got there.
Mm-hmm.
The camcorder that we used was a standard consumer-grade Sony. It's about a $900 HD camera. You don't need to use an HD if you're just recording off of standard DVD. The monitor was $300. What we did is we looked to see if there was comparable equipment at universities. And in fact, there's much better equipment at universities, which I wish we had access to.
What you saw, particularly the setup, you saw how long it took to set up the camera and make the recording. It's not anywhere near equivalent to having to get up from your book and go out into the backyard and chisel the phrase in stone and then come back and take a picture of it for use in your classroom presentation. It's pretty easy. Maybe not as easy as using a circumvention tool, but pretty easy. And again, I just can't overemphasize the fact that convenience simply cannot be the standard that you use in this proceeding. It's got to be more than mere inconvenience. And I submit to you that for virtually any audiovisual work, the ability to make a camcorded clip for non-infringing use is readily available, affordable, and not all that inconvenient. Thank you.
Could somebody hit the lights for us, please? Thank you. Okay, next up is Bruce Turnbull.
Yep.
From the DVD Copy Control Association.
Yes, I'm Bruce Turnbull of the law firm Weil, Gotchel & Manges, LLP. I'm pleased to be here, as you just said, representing the DVD Copy Control Association. We appreciate the opportunity to present our views on the various issues set forth in the hearing notice. I believe the panelists and the Copyright Office in general is familiar with DVD-CCA, so I won't go into all of our background and particulars. We are the licensor of the Content Scramble system, and I also wanted to note that we'd be happy to respond to questions on other issues that we presented written testimony on, if you had any, beyond those that are at the hearing today. as the licensor, the owner and the licensor of the technological protection measure that's at the subject of this afternoon's hearing, I wanted to make a particular point that our interest is in the preservation of the commercial viability of that technology. Now, obviously, we have a great interest in preserving the copyright owner's interests as well, but our interest is particular to the preservation of the viability of that technology. And we believe, in fact, that's what Section 1201 was aimed at principally. Now, obviously, the technological protection measure has to be for the purpose of protecting copyrighted material, but 1201 was aimed at protecting the viability of the technological protection measure. And so when you consider these exemption requests, we ask that you start with that proposition in mind. And also recall, as you have each time this proceeding has come around, that this proceeding is intended to be a fail-safe mechanism, not the ordinary course, oh, yes, we'll grant, you know, a long list of exemptions. The purpose here is to provide a fail-safe, not and at the same time to be able to preserve the viability of the technologies that are accomplishing the protections here. As an overall matter, I do want to emphasize that DVD-CCA believes that the change that was made in the 2006 decision to define class of works, at least in part based on the nature of the use or the user, was a mistake, and that you ought to go back to the previous understanding of the law and thereby actually avoid a large can of worms. Having said that, moving to the various educational exemptions at issue this afternoon, to the extent that the 2006 interpretation is maintained, as has been indicated, we do not generally oppose the renewal of the film and media studies professor exemption, nor do we oppose the inclusion of DVDs that are held by the library of the institution where the professors teach, although we would agree with the joint commenters and others who request that the exemption be limited to circumstances in which other means of achieving the professor's goals are not available. And we think there are, as has been demonstrated and discussed, a number of other such means. We do oppose the expansion of the exemption to the other purposes for a number of reasons. These proposed expansion, and let me start with the educators in general at this point. I'll get to the students in a moment. As Steve said, the proposed exemptions would exponentially increase the current exemption that's limited to film and media studies professors. And in the context, again, of focusing on the preservation of the technology as a viable matter, exponentially increasing the exemption is a very serious concern for us. As the decision in 2006 specifically stated, educators at large do not all have the same pedagogical needs as film and media studies professors whose areas of instruction are uniquely concerned with film and television qua visual mediums. And regardless of the quality level that might be desired, there are alternatives available to achieve such results without requiring the circumvention of CSS. Users can employ the camcorder method, which I think was very well demonstrated just before. That the viability of such alternatives was acknowledged by the Register in 2006 as well. As a second alternative, for a number of the requesting professors, and I went through in some detail in preparation for the hearing today, the list of uses that we've heard a number of today, the Pioneer Player would be a perfectly adequate alternative to circumvention. That was something we demonstrated in the 2006 hearing. We chose not to take your time again today, but that player remains on the market in different forms at very affordable prices. It allows the queuing of the DVD to several different places in a particular disc so that you can start at one place and then go in an order that you've created or in a random order based on the computer programming that you've done in advance. to various places in the disk, and where a single disk is at issue and can serve the purposes for a particular teaching purpose, that player is I think, a perfectly good substitute. And again, if we're talking about the variety of proposals that have been made for how to use DVDs in the classroom, I think a reasonable percentage, I didn't count all of them, but a reasonable percentage of them talked about uses that would be specific to a single disk. And there were a number of the proposals also that clearly contemplated that some educators can and do plan their courses in advance. And for them, seeking permission from the movie studios to use certain clips is a full solution to their situation. Also, the movie server that some of the studios are in the process of setting up, when that's up and available, is also a viable alternative, even if you don't have advance, because it would be available, as I understand it, simply on demand, you know, in the middle of the night and without asking in advance. In short, there are a number of reasonably available alternatives that should be sufficient to satisfy the needs of the non-film studies educators. And also a number of these should also inform the Copyright Office in relation to even the film studies professor exemption as to narrowing it to those circumstances where it's actually necessary. With regard to students and the proposal to allow them to circumvent access controls, the proposed exemptions, if granted, would really confound efforts to administer and police circumvention. Students would have a green light to hack CSS or use available hacks of CSS under the guise of class assignments. It would be difficult, if not impossible, for DVD-CCA and the owners of the content to distinguish between activity that falls under the exemption and that which does not. The difficulty of administering this exception is actually exemplified by Professor Hobbs' comments, which assert that professors can be gatekeepers of such an exemption. While the professor and others may have the best of intentions, I sincerely doubt that professors can realistically monitor such an expansive exemption. Additionally, the proponents of the exemptions articulate that, in part, the exemption is needed so that students can become familiar with basic aspects of manipulating visual media and to move students toward an audiovisual form of academic presentation. Students can certainly achieve such skills in the absence of the proposed exemption, as there's original material available from sources other than CSS encrypted movies, and there are the alternatives mentioned before to gain access to content that protected by CSS, perhaps particularly the camcorder example. An expansion of the current film and media studies exemption would undermine the technological and legal underpinning of the content protection system that is the basis for the DVD movie business. Once widespread legal circumvention of CSS is permitted, the ability to limit the scope of the use of the circumvention may well be impossible, thereby undermining the whole system. The key to that system has been to keep legitimate retailers and users from adopting the circumvention technologies that are admittedly available. As indicated at the outset, we're happy to respond to questions about the demonstrations made today, about our views on the issues that were in the hearing notice, and about our views on the exemption requests. Thanks.
Thank you. Finally, we hear from Sandra Eastars.
Thanks. Since we're coming on 4 o'clock, instead of actually making any prepared statements, I'll just try and respond to a couple of points that were made during the earlier testimony and add my knowledge of what's going on with respect to the USC Film Server project, and also talk a little bit about the non-objection letters that that we at Warner Brothers issue on a regular basis. I'd note, and I think Fritz noted similarly, and Bruce as well, that attention needs to be paid to the purpose of the proceeding and to the standard of the proceeding. And while I'm sympathetic to the educational uses that are being suggested, and in fact Warner Brothers actively works to enable such uses, I would encourage the Copyright Office to be careful not to fall into the sort of rhetorical technique that I think is being employed of suggesting that if a technical protection measure causes any sort of difficulty to anybody anywhere at any time, then it should be circumventable. That's just not the standard in the proceeding and not the purpose of the underlying law. Let me just say a few words about the USC Film Server project. We at Warner Brothers, and I'm speaking on behalf of Warner Brothers, not for any of the other studios or for the MPAA here. Warner Brothers has been working very diligently, along with other members of the MPAA, to figure out a means to facilitate educational uses of film clips by film professors. And we've been talking about this, you know, for a couple of years now, in part due to the issues raised by Professor DeCherney the last time around. The proposal that we're looking at would allow film professors to register and create an account for themselves. They could then go on and browse through a full copy of each film title that's available on the service online, and then use a custom player application to select the exact clips that they're interested in and submit automatically online a request for those clips to be delivered, and those clips would then be either made automatically accessible to them, either by way of a download or on a secure URL. And there's no charge contemplated for the clips, and there's also no requirement that the film professor or the associated school in any way establish that they have a copy of the film title for which the clips were requested. It would be simply a matter of the clips, the motion pictures that appear on the server. In terms of where we are, we're currently working with USC to develop a list of films and TV titles that are most critical to have available via the service once the service launches. And our anticipation would be that additional titles would be added over time. And the goal at the moment, we're working to identify a service provider that could operate the service. We've had an RFP out. We've interviewed numerous candidates that have made proposals. And the goal ultimately would be to try and beta test the service sometime later in the year. Admittedly, it's not up and running, and not all of the issues have been fully addressed and vetted, but I point to this only as an example of good faith efforts by the studios to try and accommodate educational uses that have been brought to our attention, and also to support some of the comments that Steve made earlier, that to the extent a exemption is granted, it should be limited to instances where it's actually necessary to use the exception rather than, for instance, go on the film server to get access to the clips. The other thing that I wanted to mention, and in the interim while the film server project is going forward, Warner Brothers continues to work with educators to try and enable their uses within a classroom of our motion pictures and of clips from our motion pictures. The requests that we get for permission to use clips are relatively infrequent and declining when it comes to educational users. I cited in my written testimony that in 2007 we only received 99 such requests, and in 2008 only 34 such requests. So we don't have evidence of the demand for these clips in from our own personal experiences that we can point to. There is one instance in which we were actually, this was in January of this year, where we were asked to supply a clip for a user to show in class. The professor had pointed to the difficulty of shuffling discs around and so forth, and we met that request, and we were able to provide the requested film by return email, and we absorbed the lab fees for that. Professor DeCherney has raised some questions about our work with educational users and has termed this a licensing scheme of some sort. I think he called it labyrinthine. But Let me just answer a couple of the points that he raised. The first being that it's not a new licensing scheme that we're offering. We're merely noting that it's possible to work cooperatively with us to get clips if you need them, and that we're, you know, doing our best to accommodate uses that are brought to our attention. As copyright owners in our films and in TV programs, we have the ability to, and we regularly do grant no objection letters to users concerning bona fide educational uses of our works. Given the nature of the uses at issue, those no objection letters tend to be based on Section 110 of the Copyright Act. The letters aren't intended in any way to represent a new alternative licensing scheme. They're simply explanations to educators that they don't need a license from us for certain uses. When we issue our non-objection letters, we waive the rights that we have to the use of the work as described by the educator to the fullest extent that we can. We waive them with respect to the copyright in the film or the television program that we own from which the educator seeks to take the clip. Obviously, there are others who potentially have an interest in those clips. The guilds were mentioned, and actors represented by the guilds have been mentioned. And so we direct educators to appropriate contacts to facilitate waiving those rights should that be necessary. And we've had no feedback from any educator to indicate that such permissions have not been forthcoming in instances where we've waived our rights. Another point that I think, I don't recall if it was Professor DeCherney or if it was Jonathan Band that raised it, was the question about whether studios will engage in censorship or fail to approve uses that present their works in a negative light. And I'd note that the proponents have not submitted any evidence to support this assertion. And in fact, to the extent this is a concern, while not directly on point with regard to educational uses, our testimony actually did include a letter from a documentarian who wished to use various clips from Warner Brothers owned movies to critique the depiction of African civilization and popular media in the 1930s in this instance. The clips that they were looking for were clips from Tarzan the Ape Man and from Bosco Shipwrecked, two movies that we own the rights to. The particular clips that they suggested they wanted to use included features of Tarzan swinging from a vine, used to demonstrate representations of African culture in popular media in the 1930s. They similarly wanted to use explorers in battle with African natives to demonstrate the introduction of white civilization in Africa. They wanted to use cannibals dancing around a fire in order to demonstrate representations of African civilization in popular media in the 1930s. And the last clip that they described was a feature of cannibals running, used to demonstrate, again, the representations of African civilization in popular media in the 1930s. The documentarians who were engaged in preparing the show contacted us and said that they believed that these uses were fair use, but they were contacting us in good faith to see whether we agreed. We issued a letter saying that, while we weren't going to opine whether it was fair use or not, irrespective of whether it is or is not fair use, our letter said that, we have no objection to the use described, and the production was able to go forward. So to the extent that there's any evidence in the record as to whether studios are likely to restrict uses of their clips because they negatively portray either the media or media culture, I would point to this as at least an example to show that that's not necessarily the case. I think the last point to mention, and it doesn't fully address all of the uses that the educators have proposed, but again, I offer it as a suggestion that the studios are, in fact, looking to be creative in enabling the sorts of functionalities and features that that people have brought to our attention. And in that regard, I'll mention the BD Live demonstration that I did this morning. I think it definitely has applications in an educational context, in particular for those who weren't present this morning. The demo shows ways in which you can add narration, either audiovisual or purely audio, and then have that narration play back while you're playing back a copy of the movie. And that's a feature that can be used both while you're in your classroom or you know, through a community screening function that can be set up with other BD Live users. There are other examples that I mentioned this morning of features that we've used in other formats and are contemplating here, some of which involve editing suites and the like. So those are just examples of ways we're trying to accommodate the interests of the educational community, and I will end there.
Thank you very much. Well, we've been going on for well over 2.5 hours. It's probably time for a break. Shall we say we'll start up again at 4:15?